from Midori House in London, and a very warm welcome to Sunday Brunch. We're live here on Monocle 24 with me, Emma Nelson. Coming up today, we get hooked on a new exhibition that examines why human beings just can't stop being addicted. Also ahead, we meet one of the most dynamic artists to come out of London. Zach Ove will talk about heritage, sculpture, and why he's an interesting neighbour. Plus, how the world deals with natural disasters.
They are going to be more common. They're going to be very devastating. And if we deal with them only by how to pick the pieces up afterwards, we're going to be overwhelmed by the rate at which they're happening. We have to figure out how to prevent the worst of the damage.
We ask one of London's most seasoned restaurateurs a burning brunch question. What do you do with your avocado? All that plus the weekend papers too. It's Sunday Brunch, live from London with me, Emma Nelson, on Monocle 24. First on today's show, from alcohol to heroin, smartphones to PlayStation, there's an awful lot to get us hooked. And a new exhibition here in London argues that we are in all some ways affected by addiction. It's being shown at a new gallery too, the Science Gallery, which hopes to bring science and art together. Well, Hannah Ridler-Hawes is the curator of Hooked, and I'm delighted to say she joins me in the studio to talk about it. Welcome, Hannah.
Thanks very much.
And you are hooked on a cup of tea, as I'm drinking a cup of coffee. So we are hooked, aren't we?
Yeah, well, we're all substance users. We all use substances and we all engage in behaviours that have the potential to become addictive. But addiction isn't just a strong preference for something. Addiction is what happens when you lose the ability to make your own choices. And that's something that we've been exploring through the exhibition.
So give us an example of something that we might not realise that we're hooked on. And I mean, I know this morning, for the first time, my phone told me how many minutes I'd spent looking at it. And frankly, I was horrified. I thought I'd spent about 10 minutes. It was a little bit more than that. So there are these things that we don't realise that we can actually get hooked on.
I think that there are an awful lot of substances and behaviours that we don't realise we could get hooked on, including sugar. Alcohol is a big one that everyone associates with addiction. Caffeine, as we've talked about, tea and coffee. I think coffee is the largest most frequently taken psychoactive substance in the world. And in fact, at the Hooked exhibition, we've had lots of caffeine experiments with some of the researchers from King's.
What have you done?
We invited people to take a free coffee, but what they didn't know is whether it was caffeinated or decaffeinated. And then they're invited to spend some time wandering around the exhibition and fill out a questionnaire that explored their use of coffee, their feelings, and looks actually how anticipation affects how we respond to a substance that has an impact on us. So if you're expecting to be woken up by your coffee, if you're expecting to feel more cheerful by it, but it's a decaf, does that expectation shape it?
And what happened?
We don't have the results yet. We're still running the project, but it's been really exciting. And that's with some of the researchers from King's.
I know I have an enormous amount of pleasure when my husband, I do hope he's not listening, I only buy decaf for our house. And he always has a cup of coffee to wake him up in the morning. He hasn't drunk caffeine for years in our house. And it's one of those things, off he goes. And I sort of have a slightly wry smile when I see him sort of say, all right, that feels better.
Well, what I don't want to do is I don't want to suggest that addiction isn't a serious problem, because for people living with addiction, it is a really serious problem. But what we count as addiction is not simply using or really, really liking a substance or behaviour. It's reaching the point where you start to experience harm. And that's harm to yourself, harm to your body, can be your looks, can be harm to your working life, your relationships. And people we've consulted in the development of the exhibition who have lived experience of addiction will say the thing that nobody understands is not that you make a choice, but actually addiction is the moment where there is an absence of choice. So that's our subtitle, when want becomes need and you become overwhelmed by a need to drink, to use particular drugs or substances, to go online to the extent that you're still sitting there having wet yourself from gaming for hours on end. There is literally one story, I think from Korea, of a gamer who died, who'd been sitting there for so long, they actually, you know. So there's some quite serious implications that happen when pleasure tips into harm.
What subject matters are you dealing with? So if you come to Hooked, what addictions will we be presented with?
We look at social media, which was a big area that our target audience, who are 15 to 25-year-olds, said they were really, really interested in and really concerned about. We look at internet, porn through our events program. We look at alcoholism and drug use. But what we're actually looking at is the patterns and the processes of addiction and recovery. And it's very important that we're looking at recovery as well, as that there's a very personal journey for anybody who finds themselves in the throes of addiction, that there are ways out, and that huge numbers of researchers are looking at a huge myriad of different ways to help people out of the addiction pattern.
Is this modern addiction, or have we always been addicted to something throughout history? I mean, smartphones have been around, well, for not very long at all, and gaming and social media, etc. And it's been seized upon extremely quickly as something that we could all get hooked on, which in many ways actually is quite laudable to do as society. We've spotted it as a problem straight away. But is it something that's in our brain that naturally, over thousands of years, has said, you must be addicted to, well, I don't know what we used to be addicted to when we were Neanderthals, but I think you get what I mean.
Well, what's quite interesting, I'm not a scientist. I'm a curator who's interpreted research by scientists and artists for the exhibition. But there's a lot of conversation in popular science about the dopamine pathway and the fact that when you go on Twitter and you see your notifications, you get a little dopamine hit. You get a little dopamine hit when you satisfy your urge or your craving for that extra drink or that hit from whatever substance you might be using. But actually, the complex conversation around dopamine is that dopamine drives us to eat as well. So we are creatures who are driven to search and to seek and to satisfy our urges, but those urges go from life-affirming or requirements for life, such as food and sex, to things that are perhaps superfluous. But again, we've always loved to be intoxicated. We're really curious. We love to expand our boundaries physically. We like to expand the boundaries of where our minds can go. I mean, these are very natural human urges, and there's nothing wrong with that. It's to be celebrated. Addiction happens when something doesn't quite go right.
So is there anything positive to come out of addiction, or is it all a very, very dark path?
I think that's a really difficult question for me to answer personally, because I haven't suffered with addiction problems. But having spoken to people who have in the course of the project, I think that people feel it when they reach recovery, they have been through a transformational experience. But it's painful and difficult, and I don't think that anyone would recommend it as a life choice.
You are now, this is the inaugural exhibition at a brand new gallery in London. Now, that is a terribly exciting idea. What is the Science Gallery about?
So the Science Gallery has quite a long history, although it's brand new in London, in that it started in Dublin, Trinity College, 10 years ago with Science Gallery Dublin. And that was so successful at bringing research and art and science and young people and older people, but the target is young, 15 to 25-year-olds, together, that I think around 5 years ago they started to roll out an international network. And there are science galleries being developed across the world, including Bangalore, Melbourne, Detroit, but London has been the very first one since Trinity to open at King's College. And what's really exciting about it, it is a gallery, but it's a gallery that is part of a public engagement strategy with a major world-class university. And that brings a very strong research core into every single project that happens.
We do have an awful lot of very good galleries in London, and a lot of them are scientifically based. I mean, just off the top of my head, you think of the Science Museum, you think of Wellcome, which again explores the idea of art, where art and science meet. How does the Science Gallery make its little voice, albeit with pretty good backing, how does it sort of like wave its little hand up and say, over here, please come and see me?
Well, we're definitely standing on the shoulder of giants, and Wellcome and Science Museum are extraordinary organisations with fantastic collections-based exhibitions. But a really significant difference between Science Gallery and those organisations is that we're not collections-based, and we are completely committed to contemporary dialogue about the issues that come up through developments in science, engineering and technology, through the parallel lenses of art and science. And that's every project. Whereas Wellcome and Science Museum work with a lot of different practitioners and commission a lot of art, but they're not committed to doing it in parallel every single time.
That's astonishing, because that means you have to come up, or the Science Gallery has to come up with an exhibition that is contemporary, which means that you cannot plan that much ahead, can you? Can you literally say, okay, well, something suddenly come up with a a discovery that has happened in some area of science. Okay, let's do an exhibition on it quickly, because that means you have to work at 100 miles an hour.
I think that's one of the real strengths of Science Gallery. So the previous director of Science Gallery Dublin, Lynn Scarfe, said the thing about Science Gallery is we see the exhibition as the midpoint, not the end point. So we see our audience as being co-researchers with us in some topics. As it happens, Hooked has been a two-year project for a subject that's, you know, it's been about 100 years that in contemporary society we've been looking at addiction in this way. But some of the projects will be developed more rapidly than that. And some of the projects will have long-term research in them, as well as more rapid-fire experiments on gallery.
Who's your audience expected for this? I mean, are we going to get busloads of tourists, or is this Londoners, or who's it?
Well, we're based in South London, and we really hope that people in the local borough are going to come, and Lambeth and Southwark are going to come. And we have a programme called The Young Leaders, which is set up through our community engagement programme, where young people from the boroughs have been selected to come and help co-curate and help co-develop projects with us. And hopefully that will mean that we're speaking to people in a language that is meaningful to them, not just old people like me.
Not old. Anna Ridlehall, thank you very much indeed for joining me on Monocle 24. Still to come on Brunch, a 20-year-old cafe finally spreads its wings. You're listening to Sunday Brunch on Monocle 24.
See that man sitting opposite you on the subway, lost in another world? Or that smart woman scribbling notes while having her flat white? Well, here's what links them. They're both listening to Monocle 24 via our free radio app that simply and seamlessly lets you tune in live or download shows for later enjoyment. Just think, you too could be settling back enjoying cultural nourishment in the form of the Monocle Arts Review, being briefed on the world of business with the entrepreneurs, or just enjoying great music with the sessions at Midori House. Come on, download the Monocle 24 app today, stick on your headphones, and have informed fun on the go. Monocle 24, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
Curtains up! Premiering in Monocle's October issue is our very first culture preview. From big box film releases to the art market's latest moves, we guide you through all you need to watch, see, and read this autumn. On our global tour, we take a peek into Helsinki's newest museum to find out how Finland's art scene is stepping up its game and consider the future of Nordic noir. Is the Scandi bubble about to burst? Not to mention more finds from Switzerland to Taiwan. In our fashion pages, our biannual Top 50 will deliver all the scarves, coats and knits you need to keep cosy and suitably sharp. Autumnal breeze or not, Tom Ford isn't afraid to bear it all. We hear from the American designer on why it's the perfect time to launch a line of underwear. We sit down with Iceland's Prime Minister to find out how the left-wing environmentalist thawed her countrymen's suspicion of politicians and get a few tips from developers and retailers making the high street worth celebrating. Plus, we meet the architects rethinking our homes for a more sustainable future. The Monocle October issue is out now on all good newsstands. Do get your copy today or subscribe at monocle.com.
The work of the artist Zach Ove has been described as a terrific riot of culture and conscience. His latest sculpture, Autonomous Morris, has just been unveiled at the Smithson Plaza, what used to be the Economist Plaza in central London. And I'm delighted to say that Zach joins me now. Welcome to Monocle 24, Zach.
Thank you very much.
Tell me about your Autonomous Morris. It's a, for those of us who haven't seen it, the way I would describe it, it's a massive head made of car parts. But I'm sure you've got a better way of describing it.
No, I think that's pretty much how I would describe it, a massive head made of car parts. It's part of an ongoing series of work I've been doing. I was making masks from cars prior to this, which were, I guess, sort of more flat wall-based objects, and very excited to get the chance to do this project. The head is made pretty much entirely of Beatles and Morris Minors. I've got a bit of an obsession with Morris Minors as well. As you know, it was a childhood car that my mother had when we were small, and it was something that I was very drawn to in that sense. I just like the idea of Morris also. Sometimes I've got this kind of weird connection to Morris dancing with Morrises also. I don't know why, but very interesting.
Tell us a little bit more about why you decided then to take these wonderful bits of cars and turn them into this glorious, powerful mask.
I guess, nostalgically, I liked those kind of elements of those particular vehicles. It gave me a kind of Mondrian palette with all those lovely 70s colours that are kind of patinaed and washed. But also the curvature in those vehicles gives me a really nice language of sort of jigsaw pieces to work with. And it becomes a really lovely assemblage or collage in that sense of textures and colour.
What came first, the head or the car?
Well, this was part of a longer journey. Let me start at the beginning. I began my fascination with making art after documenting the Trinidad Carnival. And what happened for me there was a little bit of an epiphany, because within the carnival, masquerade was being used as a means of emancipation for generations prior, right? To free local people from being duped by a kind of an oppressive colonial situation. They turned to costume and transfigurement as a way of proving that, look, we can be anything, right? The independence movement in Trinidad also began in the carnivalist movement. And mythologies were kind of developed and evolved as incredible stories, right, of characterizations that became the champions and heroes of this emancipation. So what fascinated me was, as we crossed the millennium, here we were sort of sitting with all this kind of incredible old world culture, but in a minute, it might well become antiquified, right? If you like, as the Caribbean, as you well know, kind of slowly is enveloped into a kind of more American culture in that sense. And I think what is a little bit upsetting is that once you lose that sort of secular sense of self, what happens is you end up queuing to become like almost fifth generation car park attendants in the back lots of the US. So I was interested in how one can revive those cultures and maintain them. I started looking at African art in a similar way on trips to the British Museum when thinking about the pieces for them also. And often we look at pieces made in ebony wood and have a backstory that we'll put onto those works. And what I was interested in was if I could translate things like ebony wood carvings and mask making into New World materials, could I, in a sense, recontemporize an old world tradition today?
Because you are the first Caribbean sculptor to have work on permanent display in London in the British Museum, in the African collection. What was
yes.
that like?
I know, it was very daunting having to make work in that situation and to have to be the first person to make work that spoke about, if you like, the relationship between the Caribbean and Africa. Yeah, it was a big, big step for me, and I'm very proud of the work that I managed to achieve. But in considering what to make, I was also fascinated by, if you like, the kind of mythological characters that we hold on to from Africa within the Caribbean. And in particular, I like Mokajumbis, which are stilt walkers that begin their origin in Mali and then become a very big masquerade in West Africa, but are also like across the Caribbean between Haiti, the Virgin Islands, Jamaica, Trinidad. It's something we really recognise as being an African tradition. So I thought those kind of mythical giants would be perfect for the Great Hall also to fill that space. And what I wanted to do in a way was have a 360 journey into the situation they're in now, where these Caribbean, if you like, carnival characters that still carry a very African identity sit face to face with their ancestry with all the masks downstairs in the Sainsbury's Gallery as a kind of return moment.
What was it like when you first saw your artwork literally looking at the masks that had probably inspired you?
Oh, I felt very proud. Really, 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 really proud. And I'm glad that the marriage works, but it's a homecoming.
It's a homecoming, but you were brought up both in Trinidad and England. What was that like?
It was interesting in how, I guess, in one's childhood, there's a sense of alienation in both situations. But then, I guess, later on in life, you realise that what you bring, both from Britain to the Caribbean and from the Caribbean back to Britain, in a way is what builds you. So for me, the revelation of looking at carnival, but then having a practice that brought in all the kind of cool factors of London and, if you like, a British art aesthetic in terms of how we look at things here, right, globally, it was a really interesting to be able to take those ideas back and merge them.
Is there perhaps an excitement in not quite belonging anywhere and then coming and landing in London where no one quite belongs and as a result we all really belong?
Oh, I think so, definitely. And I think in that moment you find your identity.
Tell me a little bit more about how you bring your art together. I mean, you're talking about all these amazing sources that you get from carnival and ancestry and cars. Your art has so many different things in it. When you look at a piece of your work, it's incredibly busy and it's really exciting to see. How do you start to bring together stuff? I mean, quite literally, how do you decide, OK, well, I'm going to use that bit there and this bit there and that bit there? Is there a, what's the cupboard like in your house when you're sort of like bringing stuff out?
It's awful. I mean, I'm a hoarder. And, of course, I pick up everything from everywhere. I can't pass a skip without having a look. So often I don't know. I'm just attracted to the object. You know, as any junk shop owner will tell you, I'm sure they're wide-eyed when I arrive because they know I'll always pick things up. Often I sit with stuff for a long time before it speaks to me at all about where or what it should do or be. And then in other situations like this head I've just made, literally a month ago, sitting there just looking at a pile of car bits and thinking, all right, well, I love the shape of this, I love the colour of that. And then kind of trying to play a giant jigsaw puzzle game with plastic ties and chairs to prop them up on and so forth in order to start to form something. A lot of people tend to design things on a computer or sketch. I find that quite annoyingly difficult sometimes. So I actually like to work with the objects themselves in a way.
How tricky is that to do when you're dealing with no, car bonnets, ties and
abusive.
Chairs.
Yeah, no, it was. It was really abusive. But literally, it begins in my back garden, propping up stuff on tables with chairs and bits of wood and so forth. A few hammers and nails.
Your neighbours must love you.
Oh, yeah, they do. It's special. Yeah. I used to have sharks hanging in the trees and all sorts recently. I mean, it is quite a feast on any given day. But essentially, you're making a maquette in a crude form with a loose wooden structure where things are kind of loosely bound, and then what I'll do is introduce the metalwork into that slowly as things kind of build, and then secure it off and then get rid of the maquette from the middle.
And how fast do you work?
The piece we've just put in Smithson Plaza was done incredibly fast. I think we did that in about 3 weeks, three of us.
That's quick.
Yeah.
And do you sort of take ages and ages and come back to stuff? Or once you begin, are you sort of like late nights and coffee?
Yeah, no, in a dream world, it would be nice to take ages and ages, but it's never the case because things always have deadlines. And I always imagine that when artists made art, they had years before the exhibition and months to consider. It's not the case. I mean, people throw things at you really quickly and you have to be a bit athletic in that sense. I mean, it's a bit like art pugilism, I always feel. And that you've really got to go in there and beat the thing up quickly and make it work, you know.
Creativity on a clock. Zach Hovey, thank you very much indeed
thank
for
you.
Joining me on Monocle 24. It's 10:24 here in London and it's time for a regular Sunday brunch feature, Weekend Reads. This week, Georgina Godwin hears from Dr. Lucy Jones. Her book, The Big Ones, explore how national disasters and natural disasters, I should say, have shaped us. She began by talking about the idea behind the book.
It's something of a result of my career. I mean, I'm a seismologist. I spent time studying lots of different earthquakes. I ended up in a place where we were creating scenarios, trying to get the best science put together to make sure people understood what we were really facing here in California so that we could do a better job of responding to it. And it came from a place where my frustration at how things that we know about disasters aren't getting used and trying to get that explained. But it's a lot easier to get people to understand and believe it through examples, through history, than just trying to do it from the science. So I actually had a great time doing the historical research to try and make sure I had all my details right as I wrote the book.
Because, of course, you go all the way back. I mean, you talk about Pompeii and also how, of course, at that time, people thought that this was punishment directly from heaven.
Some people still do, of course. And coming to the recognition that all human beings just hate randomness. I mean, as a seismologist, I can't predict the time of earthquakes and how upset that makes people, starting to recognize that's a general characteristic of human behavior. So we have to find something to blame it on rather than accepting that it's random. Before science gave us other answers, we turned to the gods. Some people still do. We now turn to the scientists and demand that they accept it. When it happens anyway, we blame the government. We have, you know, we've got to find somebody to blame and hold responsible. And we don't like to just say, you know, shift happens. It's going to just happen and we have to live with it.
What was the biggest natural disaster in the world?
Well, it depends, of course, on your definition of big. In terms of destruction of human life, it's actually the 1783 eruption of the Laki craters in Iceland. Now, Iceland only had 50,000 people. They lost almost a quarter of their population from the event. But the poisonous gases that came out from that event killed tens, maybe hundreds of thousands across Europe. An analysis in England suggests it's probably about 23,000 people that died that summer in 1783 from being outside and breathing these gases. And then it also led to a famine in quite a few different places in the world because it cooled the earth. That's one thing volcanoes can do. The cooling of the continents turns off the monsoons that caused a famine in Egypt that killed a sixth of their population, caused a famine in India that killed 11 million people. So it's actually that one volcano has had a greater impact on human life than any others.
I wonder what impact global warming is having on the likelihood of natural disasters. I mean, we seem to be in a bad place.
Absolutely we are. And this is absolutely made worse by climate change. I was actually first heard about climate change in 1992. I was on a board on natural disasters for our National Academy of Sciences. And I remember hearing this and just going, oh, this can't be right, right? And then, but the science is really so very simple on, you know, carbon dioxide's a greenhouse gas. We're adding carbon dioxide. And that prediction was that the increase in the rate of meteorologic disasters was going to be the first really obvious sign of the impact of climate change. And it's exactly what we're seeing now. Increased extreme heat days leading to greater wildfires, but also an increase in the number of storms because heat is energy. And it means there's more energy in the atmosphere for storms. It doesn't increase the rate of geologic disasters. We aren't going to see more volcanoes or earthquakes. But I feel quite strongly, and maybe this is another motivation of the book, that we have to, as a society, change the way in which we are coping with natural disasters because they are going to be more common. They're going to be very devastating. And if we deal with them only by how to pick the pieces up afterwards, we're going to be overwhelmed by the rate at which they're happening. We have to figure out how to prevent the worst of the damage.
And how do we do that?
Well, one thing is to remember, acknowledge that they're going to happen as you go about building. If we know that the rivers are going to be flooding more because there's more storms coming, you don't build in the floodplains and you try to get yourself up and out of them. You recognize that extreme wind events are going to become more common, and so you have building codes that make sure your roofs are tied on properly. Facing the reality of more wildfires, we really have to think about how we allow building within what's called the wildland-urban interface. And at least here in the United States, one of our issues is we used to say it's not the role of government to help you after a disaster. There was even a president that at one point said, we need to remember that the people support the government. The government does not support the people. Well, we've shifted in that sort of hard-hearted attitude, and we are more willing to see government providing disaster assistance. But we haven't shifted in saying, well, the government doesn't get to tell an individual what to do with their private property. And yet, if the government, if all of us are going to be on the hook for paying for the consequences of these disasters, we need to be involved in the decisions that can prevent them as well.
On to the very scary part, which is that you say most world cities have the potential for a big one in their future. I mean, it's likely that most of us at some point in our lives will be involved in something like this then.
No, because you don't live that long. Every city is likely to have it at some point from some type of disaster or not. But any individual only, of course, occupies the city a relatively small time of the city's outcome. And sort of by definition, the really big ones that are capable of disrupting society don't happen very often. If it's something that happens commonly, we will have built to handle it. You know, those are the sort of building code changes that do happen. It's the less frequent but bigger events that can completely change the nature of society that aren't incorporated in our rules. So that's where I'd like to see changes really coming along, is accepting that with science we can now say, what are those bad ones? Maybe not in my future, but my grandchildren's or my great-grandchildren's future, and plan for those as well.
Finally, Lucy, what do you hope readers will take away from this book?
I think I want them to take two things. One is to recognize this human fear of randomness and use it as a filter when people tell you they know when some disaster is happening, because we're so drawn to the need for pattern that we listen when we shouldn't. But the second thing is that the natural hazards are inevitable, but the disasters are not, and we really can do something about them.
That was Lucy Jones talking to Georgina Godwin. Lucy Jones's book, The Big Ones, How Natural Disasters Have Shaped Us and What We Can Do About Them, is out now. You're listening to Sunday Brunch. It's 10:32 here in London. We go through the newspapers next.
Our very own Monocle Library is growing into a robust collection of well-turned-out titles. For an in-depth look into our core theme of quality of life, why not delve into our first-ever book, The Monocle Guide to Better Living? For any would-be business leaders, entrepreneurs, or even established companies in search of fresh ideas, there's The Monocle Guide to Good Business. In How to Make a Nation, a Monocle Guide, we look at the small and the big things that can help make our nations work better. And in The Monocle Guide to Drinking and Dining, we bypass the foam and the fuss to uncover the makings of a truly great meal. Monocle's handsome books are published by our friends at Gestalten in Berlin and offer a world of new experiences between the covers. So spruce up your shelves today and buy some of our titles online at monocle.com or from any good bookstore.
The Monocle Weekly, our original Sunday show, brings you the best interviews with the writers, artists, thinkers, and innovators that shape our times. Also featuring fearless presenters.
It's not illegal, but it does have an effect.
Uh-oh. Are you ready for this, Tom?
I could do with some stimulation and some relaxation. How traumatized am I going
to
be?
How much of this do we need to drink to get an effect?
All of it.
Who ask the probing questions.
What is the kinkiest animal?
The mantis.
That's pretty kinky.
Headless. Thrusting.
And a good old-fashioned star turn or two, just for good measure.
We had a small editorial conference today where everyone was going, what do you think of Kylie's concert? When did you go? When are you going? What's happening?
So, yeah, I heard you guys had a debrief.
Yeah, we've had a debrief.
That's the Monocle Weekly. Sundays at 12 noon London time on Monocle 24. You wouldn't want to finish your week without it.
Right, it's time to go through the newspapers. I'm joined in the studio by Cornelia Meyer, who's the CEO of Meyer Resources, a business consultancy and a regular Monocle 24. Welcome back, Cornelia. Thank you for going through the papers so that those of us who haven't yet wandered down to the newsstands to decide what they want, it's a sort of a little bit of a taster. What have we found?
Well, I have found Theresa May has been very active after the party conference and written an op-ed or a commentary in The Observer, where she sort of sets forth her economic plan going forward. You may recall when she went into Downing Street, she said she wanted a fair Britain and it should be there for everyone. And that's what she said. Beyond after Brexit, it will be the end of austerity, as she has said during the party conference. And, you know, the human being in me is just thinks this is all very good and I want this country to be there for everybody. But the economist in me says, oh dear, How is she going to do that? Because if you get rid of the, if you don't increase the fuel tax, that's 800 million that you don't take. If you want to give more money to the NHS, to education, and so on, not go up with taxes and go down with the debt levels. I just don't see how you physically can do that. And then she says, okay, we need more housing stock, where she's right. So let us scrap the cap for local councils, where, how they can borrow to build houses. That's nice. But what she does is she just pushes debt down a level below the national level.
Well, it's an astonishing thing because I think a lot of people now have this real issue with the difference between Theresa May on paper and Theresa May, the person who speaks. And also the Theresa, what she says, I remember when she assumed the leadership of the Conservative Party and became Prime Minister. And she spoke in very much a way that we're reading in this article. It's like, if you're just about managing, I am here for you. If you're feeling underrepresented, I am here for you. And yet within minutes, I think everybody found out that actually the Conservatives were at loggerheads with each other and this was never going to happen. And the Labour Party have exploited the gaps, the social gaps that seem to be deepening in Britain. Is there something credible about Theresa May in this article we haven't seen before?
I'm sure her heart is there. She's a vicar's daughter. And, you know, when you hear her speak, it is a little bit like going to church because she says things like, it is right to do it. And it is a little bit like going to church on Sundays. But the thing is, she has to manage within a party. Within a party is quite right wing. What she's trying to do, what the head of the of Labour said very eloquently, he said in a different article in The Observer, she's trying to capitalize on the malaise in Labour with anti-Semitism and so on. She's trying to push us to the left and push us out there. And, you know, that's probably the job of a politician. But it is difficult. And, you know, it's a very dangerous road to travel, I think, to say after Brexit, life will be good, the birds will be singing, and it will be the end of this austerity, because Brexit will be a major, major economic shock to this country.
And no one has quite actually examined this. I mean, this is something that she just sort of brushes into two or three lines. This means getting the best Brexit deal for Britain. Yeah. So when we have secured a good Brexit deal for Britain, it's that thing that goes back to strong and stable again. This girl has a message, but she never has an example to back it up.
Yeah, and it's a little bit, I was very amused or very bewildered when she came in and she said, I want Brexit means Brexit and we're going to make a success of it. And, you know, I'm probably just not smart enough. I didn't get it.
I don't think you're the only one, Cornelia.
Then she did the red, white and blue Brexit. That had left me totally bewildered.
I think it left and most of the European Union and many British people too as well. There's also her, she's now decided to take this new tack, or rather her communications team have taken a new tack in terms of setting out an argument in a newspaper to the public. It was only about 3 or 4 weeks ago that she set out an argument in the German press about as a message to Europe about how she wished to sort of drive Brexit. That went down like a cold brick, didn't it?
I understand why she does it. I mean, there's one thing, she has the columnist supreme nipping at her heels, Boris Johnson. So she needs to be seen, at least in this country, in the papers. Also, I think she's probably rather shy, and you know, her television presence is not that wonderful. So she's probably more a woman of the written word, and she probably feels more comfortable doing that. So yeah, that's legitimate.
Absolutely. It's quite nice to read something, isn't it? Right, let's move to El País. We have the Brazilian elections taking place. And as things stand, polls haven't quite opened just yet, but it looks like the far-right candidate is likely to secure at least a third of the vote.
Yes, Bolsonaro, the far-right candidate, who is sort of in a vein of Duterte in the Philippines, Donald Trump, Viktor Orban. It is the age of the strong man. And, you know, I think the Brazilian people are really fed up with what has happened under the last 10 years of corruption. They're very fed up with crime. And he comes out with this, you know, zero tolerance for crime message, be it's a Catholic country, let's be good to families. So that resonates with a lot of people. And it was very interesting when you watched the election unfold, you know, Fernando Haddad, the left-wing candidate, and his deputy, they were on all these rallies, and you had this Lula da Silva, who's now sadly in jail, was sort of behind them like sort of a ghost in a poster. It was just, the visuals were wonderful.
One thing about this man, though, and this is providing and offering a tremendous sea change for Brazil, is his anti-gay, anti-ethnic minority stance. Now, these are two attitudes which, frankly, do not chime with modern Brazil at all.
No, they don't chime with modern Brazil at all. But it is, again, it is Viktor Orban, Duterte. These people are all trying, some of our politicians, which we'll leave nameless, all trying to get the country, Trump trying to get their countries back into the 1950s. So I think there is a certain mood in the world for regression.
Speaking of regression, let's talk about Brett Kavanaugh. In the last few hours, he's been confirmed and sworn in as a member of the Supreme Court, creating such an enormous division within the United States, or rather exposing the division within the United States, given the fact that Donald Trump basically said this was a huge personal victory for him. It seems as if justice has been left along the wayside, doesn't it?
Well, I'm not sure where I come out on this one. I think there was probably a good reason for more investigation, but and you know, I totally see the validity in the Me Too movement and all of these things. He was accused by several women of having sort of transgressed and on the sort of that sexual level. If we just go out and we accuse people and we immediately back with the accuser, that's not justice either. So, you know, the court of public opinion is not a court. The court is a court. Where I am worried about Kavanaugh, wherever we come out on this, is when you saw him come out and defend himself, he was so partisan, so biased, so angry, and that is not the demeanor of what... I'm not an American, but if I was an American, that would not be the demeanor I would like to see in a Supreme Court justice.
Absolutely. There seemed to be no legal argument and there are no reasoning. This was a hysterical politician or a very angry, passionate politician. Now, what can understand if you are a man accused? But like you say, you need a cool head when deciding on enormous cases of legal significance.
But in his defence, he obviously was playing to his supporter, Donald Trump. And if he had come across as a reasonable man, that might not have worked. But the one thing I'm concerned about in terms of where the Supreme Court is going, we now have a very conservative balance. He's replacing Anthony Kennedy, who was right wing, but who was always the swing vote. And we have Roe versus Wade, which is the abortion right. We have, which could be overturned potentially, although Kavanaugh says he will go with jurisprudence as it has been spoken with the history of it. But then we have the undermining, chipping away at the EPA and all of those institutions. So that really concerns me. And the last thing I'll say here is, because he was so partisan, there will be, when the Supreme Court judges on certain things, there will be people asking for him to be recused or to recuse himself. And that's not a good thing when on your way in, you already know that on a certain percentage of cases, you have to recuse yourself.
There are certain elements, though, that what I heard today really, really brought things into sharp focus, regardless of the process that we have witnessed and the right and the wrong and the elements that the FBI couldn't get on with given the task they were given. Someone has just said Donald Trump has already just this weekend secured his legacy. Even if he only survives another 2 years or another 6 years, he has secured a right-wing conservative Supreme Court for a generation.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. And that's exactly where I come out and say, I fear for things like institutions like the EPA. And let us not forget, it was Richard Nixon who brought the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, into life. So, but compared to Donald Trump, Richard Nixon looks positively revolutionary.
Once upon a time, let's move on now. Once upon a time, everybody thought that the Russian Secret Service and Russian spies were really, really brilliant at what they did. But events in the last few months suggest that they are otherwise. And there's an article in the Sunday Telegraph which suggests that they're doing all manner of strange things underwater now.
Well, I don't think they're bad. When the Soviet Union broke up, Russia had to sell off or bring to the junkyard a lot of its navy. But under Putin, under Vladimir Putin, this has come up again, and they're sort of at it, and they're especially at it in the North Atlantic. And what this article says is that the powers that be, both in America, in NATO, and in the United Kingdom, are worried about the cable. The underwater cables that transport information, especially financial information, between New York and Europe. And they have a point. So everybody's now following these highly good subs and to try and see where they are. And even you know, earlier this year, America reestablished its second fleet, which is responsible for patrolling the North Atlantic. You know, that was abolished in 2011 because one thought, oh, well, you know, the Russians don't really have a navy anymore. But they did come back.
I think what's amazing here is that the Sunday Telegraph just briefly summarises what we believe the Russians to have done, or what we can establish as well. In recent years, Russia has annexed Crimea, stoked civil war in Ukraine, and meddled in the US election. There's been an increase in Russian activity under the North Atlantic as well. It has been a huge test for the great institutions and the great countries of this planet to try and work out what to do about Russia.
Yes, but I think there's one thing. If you have a US president who tries to chip away at NATO, this is a clear case which proves to us that we need NATO. And when I look at it, yeah, Russia does things, but Russia does what Russia has ever traditionally done over hundreds of years vis-a-vis Europe. Where we really need to watch is what China is doing with Belt and Road, with in the Pacific. So we should really, this is what's happening geopolitically on that Eurasian continent is very important. So we shouldn't just over laser beam focus on Russia, but obviously we should be with the program and do what NATO seems to be doing here.
Right, let's move on to the Süddeutsche Zeitung. A wonderful, beautiful, beautiful picture for starters. A lovely in-depth examination of fears and the future of libraries. Take us through this article, because it's a meaty article, but it's terribly thoughtful too.
If it was the FT, it would be the big read times two. In terms just of, to give the readers a view of how long it is. But it is it says, well, do we need libraries? And it argues very strongly, yes, we need libraries. And it says, look, if you look at Google, says last year alone 130 million new book titles were published, and in Germany alone 72,499. So they all need to go somewhere to have that repository of their cultural heritage. Libraries are also cultural heritage, and as the article also argues, which is true, you know, it's not just the reading of the book; it's how the book fits into its environment, the other books that go into it, and also the how the book is bound, how the book is presented, printed, says a lot about the time, you know, the zeitgeist of when the book was written. Then there is a guy who runs the library for the ETH, which is the technical university which produces a lot of Nobel Prize laureates in physics and chemistry and so on, who says we don't need libraries anymore, which I would disagree with.
Yeah, I think we're going to have to have a word with him. Cornelia Meyer. I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there. Off to the libraries we go. That's Cornelia Meyer. Thank you very much indeed for joining me on Sunday Brunch on Monocle 24. Finally,
this Sunday. There's a reason why we call it Sunday Brunch, and it's because we quite like to invite people who kind of know what brunch is all about to tell us how they do it. And I'm delighted to say that Simon Gregory from Bluebird, the Bluebird Cafe, joins me in the studio now. Simon, thank you for coming back into Monocle 24. This is your second visit, isn't it?
Yeah, I came down at Christmas time, and it's great to be back. Thanks for having me.
And you brought mince pies then. What have you brought today?
Today we just brought a bit of love and a little bit of chat. Sorry, no food today, but a little bit of love.
I'll forgive you. The Bluebird Cafe, for those of us who may not have been, it's been around for, what, 20 years in London. I don't like using the word icon very much, but let's say it's a big old landmark down there, isn't it? It's a huge part of the culture.
It's a big place, and it's got a great history. It's been there a long time. We've got a restaurant, cafe there, bars. I mean, it's been there a long time, and I've been with the company now a bit over a year, so it was really quite an exciting time to start with the team from Bluebird. We're expanding. We've just opened a Bluebird in New York not 3 weeks ago in the Time Warner building overlooking Central Park, which is very cool. And then this year, we've had a busy year. We've opened another Bluebird out by the iconic television centre in West London, which has been pretty exciting as well. So, yeah, it's a lot going on.
It's an interesting idea, actually, to have a cafe that doesn't expand for 20 years and which makes its name by just having this amazing brand, and then suddenly you start to move out and about. How do you create a balance that you say, okay, everybody knows Bluebird, everybody knows why we're so good, but how do we keep it when we start opening it in places we've never been before?
I think with expansion, so long as it's done in a controlled way and that you are able to keep the kind of idea of the original concept and then just drive with that. You want each site to develop individually. You want them to have their own unique point. And so long as you keep the core of what you do best like that and control that and then let the team expand from that, it creates something quite special. We're trying to do things that we're not doing things that were the same as what they were 20 years ago, but we're trying to take an idea from that original model and then just make it a little bit, 2018.
So if I just stumbled off the King's Road into the Bluebird Cafe, what would I be greeted with? What would you serve me to eat, to drink and to have fun with?
I think we've got quite a diverse menu in Chelsea. I mean, downstairs in the cafe, going in for breakfast, and, we're talking about brunches. Things like Nduja omelette, the Calabrian sausage on a nice open omelette with some smoked Gruyere cheese, or you could have your eggs Benedict.
I'm just contemplating the sausage, the cheese, and the egg all in one go, and then I'm slowly sliding under the table and not emerging until about 3:30. That sounds knockout.
It's really good. It's just like, I think that you get that spice from the Calabrian sausage and, that melted smoked cheese and eggs, and it's the sort of thing people like to eat for breakfast and brunch, and it does really well. And then, you take the avocado on toast, which everyone does and everyone loves, and out at the television centre in White City, we're doing one with a nice little toasted cornbread, nice crushed avocado, really spiced hot sauce and crushed chilies and coriander and poached eggs, and it's essentially avocado on toast, but just a little bit different and make it a little bit hot and a little bit spicy. So
I was about to say, what do you do to an avocado now to make its life a little bit more interesting? Some add a little squeeze of lemon, another touch of garlic, lots and lots of crunchy salt. I don't know, but if several of us will, I suspect, as we listen to this, be standing in the kitchen holding an avocado, eyeing it up, going, right, what do I do with you now? For those people in that position, what are you telling them? What should they reach for?
I think that avocado is probably one of the most widely used, ingredients across the world now. And I remember as a child, my parents would cut open avocado and put lemon juice on it. And it was like this, it was a big grand night out. Oh, we're having half an avocado before dinner. And that was really quite wow. And I was like looking at it thinking, what's that? I hated them. Absolutely awful.
But
it was very posh. It was a very posh thing to do, half an avocado with cracked pepper and lemon juice.
Oh, we went one step further around ours because my mum made a little, an avocado vinaigrette was absolutely the cat's pyjamas. We never had a prawn cocktail in our house. Bit too down market for my mum, but an avocado vinaigrette, we're on to a winner. And she would chop a little bit of, she'd do the basic mustard vinaigrette, but then she would chop a bit of spring onion into it.
That was
posh.
That just lifted it up a little
bit. That just lifted it up. But then you had the kind of like the puddle. You had the little swimming pool of vinaigrette
in the
middle.
And
it's food that you can play with.
That's it. And I think that I think that obviously with travel and obviously logistics of, you know, getting produce now with the world open up so much, obviously it's become such an acceptable thing. So I think that people will fundamentally eat avocados. I mean, the NHS have one of the highest rates of injuries is actually cuts from people opening avocados. It's quite incredible. It's one of the biggest injuries that go through hospitals in the UK. Anyway, that said, I think that with that travel and with opening the world up, the idea of whatever you want to add to an avocado, it's incredible. And people will have it for breakfast. They have it for their brunches, their lunches, and, you know, back in the day, the posh stuff, you know. And no one will forget the posh stuff. I'll never forget that. I found it the most odd thing ever, but it was super posh.
It was amazing, good fun. Did you eat the avocado? Did you just turn your nose up at it?
When I was a child, yeah. I turned my nose up at it. Now I eat them every day. Yeah. I quite like them.
So what else? Okay, so you've floored us under the table with a sausage and cheese omelette, and then you've all injured yourselves in the kitchen trying to drum up a beautifully smashed avocado, although I'm sure you're practiced in your technique. What else is it? What else is a good brunch? If you know, if we can't make it to the Bluebird today, but we're scrabbling around our kitchen wondering what we should do for our Sunday brunch, what is it, Simon, that you'd like to do at your house?
I think one of the things that, like, the, you know, I've got a couple of kids, and obviously we want them to kind of enjoy what they eat and be a little bit healthy and learn a little bit. So, you know, it's all about having great eggs. And my daughter's got to a point now, she knows a good egg from a bad one. So if it's not got a really rich yolk, she won't eat it because it's not a good egg. So that's always good. So just, it's all about the quality of the produce you use, exciting produce. A dish that we did just recently when we opened New York was this lobster Cobb salad, which is obviously a Cobb salad's a very American thing, but we did it with some incredible poached lobster, and then we mixed it up with the eggs, bacon, and the chopped lettuce, and a really nice lobster vinaigrette, and some sliced poached lobster on the top, and it just worked a treat. Would I have it at home on a Sunday? It's a little bit too luxe for my house, but with the kids, but it's a fantastic dish, and I think people, the way they are, it's more about people being together and sharing those times with family and friends. And the food, it's becoming such an important part of brunches, I guess, because it is that time of the week when people get together, people are going out, people are sharing that time with friends. And so obviously it's got to be good food because that's part of the experience. And I think that brunches are becoming more luxe and more a thing, whereas in the past it may have just been a poached egg dish. Now that it's, and the competition in London for the good brunches is that you have to make your menu really quite exciting and have as a quite a big offering and a wow offering. So I think that's the key to making it successful.
Simon Gregory, thank you very much indeed for joining us on Monocle 24. And Simon's restaurant, Bluebird, is in Chelsea on the King's Road and can also be found in White City in the west of London. And you've just opened in New York too. Busy man.
Thanks for having me. Thank you.
And that's all we have time for this edition of Sunday Brunch here in London. Thanks for your company. And thanks too to our producer and studio manager, George McDonough, our researcher, Mirjana Lagrasta. Coming up, we have Villagers on the Midori House Sessions, some live music just around the corner. And then from midday, Tom Edwards and Augustin Macellari bring us hijinks in the Monocle Weekly. But for now, from me, Emma Nelson, it's goodbye. Thanks for listening. Have a great brunch.